yourself a song, sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today, topic, Federal Reserve Interest Rate decision here just a couple days ago. What does it mean? Why did the Fed not raise rates? Interesting question. We'll address that here shortly in the first part of the program. And then I want to talk about corporate cash piles. Globally, corporations in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world have been piling up the cash at record levels. We still have cash at record levels here in corporations. Oh, they're not investing in real assets to create jobs and so forth. Very little real investment going on. In that regard, yes, and, you know, they're record levels of stock buybacks and dividend payouts and private equity and hedge firms distributing interest in massive trillion amounts here to their partners. Yes, we got huge corporate cash piles even after trillions of dollars of distributions to their shareholders and investors. What does that have to do with interest rates? Well, we'll see. There is a connection here, no doubt. Okay, let's talk about federal interest rate decision. A couple days ago, chairwoman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, our central bank, you know, Janet Yellen made a decision here. Well, actually, they all make a decision. It's a collective decision. You know, the bankers make sure that they don't have individuals making decisions in these key bodies, that there's plenty of other people who can sort of dampen any radical decisions by central banks. Make sure the central banks really reflect the private banks' interest, which has always been the case. You see, central banks were created, the Federal Reserve was created in 2013. Why was it created then? To bail out the banks. What are the purposes and functions of a central bank? First of all, to bail out the private banks when they periodically overextend themselves, and they always do, and to come up with a way of refloating the private banks. In other words, making good their losses, subsidizing them. Yeah, that's what the central bank is about, first and foremost, always. Well, secondarily, it's about trying to control the money supply and therefore interest rates. But the primary function is bailout. The secondary function is bank supervision and or interest rate manipulation, right, through the money supply. You know, what are interest rates? Interest rates are just the price of money. And like all prices, determined at one level by supply and demand. So if I increase the supply of money, technically I can lower the interest rate. Well, you wonder why interest rates are near zero for banks to borrow? By the way, only banks can borrow from central banks. You and I can't. And they're borrowing at near zero. Yeah, for free. It's free money. It's what, 7 years now of free money? If you're a bank, you go to the Federal Reserve, you get free money. In other words, you don't have to pay for it. Well, that's because we've had this massive increase in liquidity, i.e. money supply, from the Federal Reserve and all the central banks in the world. So we have a tremendous supply of money increase out there, which has driven the interest rates down. Of course, prices, interest rates, are also a function of the demand for money. Supply and demand. determines the interest rate. Well, since 2009, it's been overwhelmingly supply, flooding the market with massive amounts of liquidity. Central banks. Well, central banks have been doing that since the 1970s, by the way. That's why we have so much liquidity floating around, sloshing around the global economy. We've had decades of the U.S. and other central banks pumping all this money into the global economy. Well, why did they do it initially? Why in the 1970s did this occur? Well, it occurred because the U.S. Gave the deep six to the Bretton Woods international monetary system, where the dollar was pegged to gold, and we got off the dollar standard. So there was no way for, well, the quasi-dollar standard wasn't the true dollar standard, but we got off of that, and the whole world got off of that, which left, how do you regulate fluctuations between different currency exchange rates around the world? Well, it was left up to central banks to do that. Only central banks could try to buy and sell each other's currencies to try to keep all the currencies within a certain fluctuation. Well, why was that important, to keep currencies within a certain band? Well, because if without that, you would get one country trying to get an advantage against another country by devaluing its currency. And then everybody could do that, and everybody devalues their currency to get a short-term advantage. Well, that's what happened during the Depression of the 30s. They were all devaluing their currencies to get a short-term advantage, and it was a race to the bottom, and global trade collapsed, you see. So you need to some way prevent fluctuations between different currencies to keep things stable in the global economy. Well, with the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in the 1970s, this was no longer the case. So it was left up to central banks to try to keep each other's currency within a reasonable range. But to do that, you got to pump money into the economy. And since the U.S. was the primary central bank, you know, the U.S. kept pumping money in. Whenever there was instability, whenever there was a banking crisis, we'd pump more money in. Whenever there was a recession, pump more money in. Well, we didn't take it out, you see. We just kept pumping it in, pumping it in. Well, you know, a lot of U.S. capitalists liked that idea. Because the dollar was a global currency, and the more money you pumped into the global economy, the more multinational companies could use to buy up other companies around the world. It's part of U.S. imperialism, you know, the dollar, key element. And the central bank pumps money in. And, of course, we needed more money to maintain all our growing global empire. You know, foreign aid, military aid, and all this kind of stuff, wars fought abroad, you know. All the money brought into Iraq and Afghanistan in suitcases, yes, literally in suitcases, and disappeared on bribes. Okay, so, you know, flooding the world with liquidity, every time there's a financial crisis, every time there's a recession, to finance global expansion of the business, to finance the U.S. imperial objectives, you know, over the decades, this all sort of increases. So now you've got trillions and trillions of dollars, literally dollars, floating around the world. Okay, and causes instability. In fact, there's more dollars than can be used for real investment to make things. So it goes into financial speculation. Right? And in the last 7 years, it's pretty clear that the global economy is addicted to free money. Can't get off of it. It's fixed. It's, you know, it needs that fix. The fix is called quantitative easing. And zero interest rates, ZIRP, Z-I-R-P, zero interest rate program or policy, ZIRP. Zero rates and QE. What's QE, quantitative easing? Well, if zero rates are okay, bankers, private bankers, you can come and get free money from us and then go loan it out to you know, or use it to buy stocks in the stock market or you know, send it abroad, right, or speculate in foreign exchange currencies, Forex speculation, you know, or buy bonds, private corporate bonds, and all this stuff, you know. Well, the banks get the free money and they loan it to shadow banks, you know, who go and speculate with it, or they loan it to offshore or wherever, and they get, you know, 5-10% interest, you know, for free money. That's how the banks make their money, by speculation and free cost of money from the Fed and central banks that they then reloan out to the speculators around the world, right? And that's how this money flows out from the central banks, like the Federal Reserve, into the global economy through the banking system, you see. And we've got a global economy out there that the central banks, the Fed in particular, have been feeding this free money, and everyone's addicted to it now. They can't get off of it. It's such a golden goose for bankers and shadow bankers and investors and so forth. And the real economy isn't really growing. You know, if you look at real global investment, by real investment, I mean investing in real things and, you know, and expanding production and manufacturing and so forth and all that. Yeah, there's some of that still going on, but it's slowing dramatically. Over the last 15 years in particular, you can see the numbers are going down, down, down everywhere. At the same time, investment in financial assets is going up, up, up. We're becoming financialized, as they say. Well, why do investors like financial assets so much? Well, because they're more profitable. Look, I can take my money, I can get the free money from a bank who gets the free money from the Federal Reserve, and I can put it in currencies, right? Speculate on currencies, the movement of currencies up and down, and we got a lot of volatility in currencies going on now because of all the QEs around the world, right? A lot of volatility there. I can make money as a speculator investor on the movement of prices for money called foreign exchange manipulation, and I can manipulate it too. Yes, they do that as well. All kinds of, you know, cases, legal cases against foreign exchange manipulation all around the world going on now as governments desperately try to get some control over that but aren't really succeeding. And now we have all this technology, fast trading, right? Fast trading, I take a large amount of money and bet on before everyone else bets, and, you know, I make a penny here, but I spent $1 billion, so I'm, you know, make $100 million, whatever. Fast trading allows me, just give me all the free money you can give me, you know. I'll arbitrage it. I'll play the shift in the price, however minuscule it is. Or if I'm a rich investor, I'm not going to go buy stock on a New York Stock Exchange, whatever, directly, so people know I'm betting this. You know, I'm going to put it into a dark pool, you know, which means I'm a preferential investor, and I can secretly buy and sell stuff, stocks and bonds, you know, and the bank will give me preferential treatment, allow me to do that. You know, maybe a third of all the trading going on now is in dark pools. You see, the more secret things are, the more money you can make. The more you can bend the rules, and the less obvious it's going to be that you're breaking the rules, and therefore you'll get stuck with your hand in the candy jar and sued by the SEC or something, see? So you want to keep it as secret as you can. That's what it's all about, big investors. So financial asset investment is really very profitable. It's done behind the doors, and, It's done quickly based on price appreciation. You know, I'm not going to worry about making something and then can I get suppliers, you know, and what are they going to charge me? Then I got to hire people, you know, and they're going to ask for more money and so forth. You know, yeah, you can still make some money like that if you're an Apple, you know. But more and more investors don't want to tie up their money long run. They want to jump into a market and jump out. They want to go into a liquid market, a financial market, a foreign exchange market, a junk bond market, right? an exchange traded funds, ETF market. Put my money in, take my money out, even stocks, you know, although real serious investors don't buy stocks. So that's financial asset investment, and much more profitable. If something goes wrong in the market, I can get out of there right away. How can I get out of making cell phones or something when I'm halfway in there and it looks like the market's collapsing, right? It's not easy. You tie up your money, but financial investment, you can jump in, jump out, right? You're going after a price appreciation, or you can even bet on a price collapse and make money. In fact, you create the price collapse and you make money. I mean, look, big investors in China are making money on the collapse in China. The collapse of the stock market bubble in China has been going on for 3 months now. $5 trillion lost in valuations over there. They made money on the way up. They make money on the way down. And, you know, the China government's desperately trying to find out all these speculators and, you know, throwing the book at them when it can. But, you know, they just find the tip of the iceberg. Most of them get away with it. And then they take their money out of China and they run. Yeah, the money's flowing now to Western and European and U.S. Property markets. These rich speculators in China taking their money and putting it in real estate outside of China. They made their killing. Okay, so financial asset markets are really attractive. Now, what does all this have to do with interest rates and corporate cash piles? Well, I'll tell you, right? Again, the interest rates, very low rates, make it very lucrative to borrow free money and take it and use it in financial speculation all over. That's how these stock markets have gotten so darn high and remain up there. You know, they drop 5-10%, you know, except in the case of China, because that went up 120% appreciation in 1 year in China. Well, if it goes up too fast, too high, well, it's going to have to come down some. And that's what's happening over there. But in the U.S., what happened to the stock and the bond markets? Well, over 4 or 5 years, they doubled and tripled. Right? See, the U.S., they're pretty darn smart capitalists here. They're not dummies. They know how to pull it off. So, you know, low interest rates feed financial asset bubbles. That's where most of the money goes. Free money from the Fed, put it into financial asset markets. I don't want to put it into making things. You know, that's too risky. I don't want to move my money around. And today we have this structure around the world, this global financial liquid market structure. And we have electronic and moving of money electronically. I can move it immediately in the split speed of light, you know, from Singapore, you know, over to Dubai. There it goes. And then after I made my penny on my $100 million investment there, you know, I'll move it back to Frankfurt. And then I'll, you know, move it to New York or whatever. In the course of a day, the money will flow. You know, huge amounts of money will flow from electronically from one market to the other market, buy and sell immediately, go to the next one, so forth, you know. Being able to move in and out real quick is more profitable. Allows me just to focus on price to make money, speculative profits, financial asset profits. You know, and how much is this, all this financial asset profits? Well, you can see a little bit of that picture, you know, when you look at stock and bond markets that are open and public, but a lot of it goes on behind the scenes. You know, that's what all derivatives are all about. There's no open trading of derivatives except interest rate, what swaps maybe in Chicago. But you know, most of the stuff is still behind the scenes. The capitalists, finance capitalists got this all rigged, you know. They move their money around behind the scenes and make money out of money. See, that's what's different today. You know, increasingly in 21st century global capitalism, money isn't made from making and selling things. Money is made from making and selling money. Increasingly, that's what it's all about. That's where the big, quick profits are. Now, there's about 200,000 very high net worth investors around the world. Now, most of them in the U.S., but a large number in Europe and in Asia now. Relatively few in Latin America and Oceania and none in Africa. And these are the people who, you know, have $25 million every year in net income. I'm not talking about assets. Income gains, income flow, cash flow. $25 million. 200,000 of them. And they're the ones who move their money around. Well, there's corporations, too, and others, right, involved. But this is the core. This is the core of the new finance capital elite of the 21st century, you know. You won't find an analysis of this at all in your classic textbooks, economic textbooks, you know, and economists, academic economists, you know, they have no idea, most of them, what's going on here on the finance side. You know, they still got their head in the sand of these old economic theories that go back decades that are totally irrelevant in many ways to 21st century reality of global capitalism today. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. That's why they can't forecast anything anymore. You know, it's worthless. Those whole approaches are worthless. By the way, my new book, let me plug it, coming out in another month here, Systemic Fragility in Global Economy. A third of the book is dedicated to debunking a lot of this academic mainstream economic theory, which is totally outmoded. Right. And even 21st century Marxist economists got their head in the sand, don't understand finance either. No. The only ones that come a little bit closer are those, you know, who are the followers of Minsky. Ivan Minsky, an economist in the 80s and 90s who tried to refocus on the role of finance. But even his views were early. Of course, he couldn't see 21st century. Made some significant contributions. I talk about him, too. But, you know, he couldn't see the whole picture either. So they're all floundering around trying to understand what's going on. But unless you understand the global finance capital today and how it's changed, you can't understand anything. And that brings us back to Fed rates, Federal Reserve interest rates. Once again, the main role there is to keep interest rates very, very low. So the banks and other finance capitalists can borrow the money and use it mostly to speculate. And these financial asset markets, these global liquid markets around the world where huge amounts of money are made overnight instantaneously. Now, capitalists like, professional investors like making money that way. Why take the risk of investing in real things and you got to wait 6, 10, 12, 2 years to get a return? Then you got all these other competitors out there. You know, all these other risks. Make money for money. Don't make money to make things to make money. See, that's where the Marxists are wrong, or a certain wing of them anyway. They think that profits are a function of making things where workers add their value to the products, right? And then the capitalists take the value from the workers, give them a little pittance part of it called wages. And then they turn around and take that back after they give it to you. Yeah, that's true, and that still happens. But most of the profits aren't from production of goods. Most of the profits now, and increasingly so, are from exchange, speculation in the financial side where money capital gets circulated. That's where it's all going on. You know, Marx kind of mentioned that, but he didn't really get to delve into it deeply. Anyway, enough of the critique of mainstream Marxist economics. And back to the Federal Reserve interest rate. Why did they keep it at virtually zero after 7 years? And they know, they absolutely know, they, policymakers, know they're creating bubbles with this stuff, financial asset bubbles in the U.S. and around the world. You know, you would not have a stock market in the U.S. that reached 18,000, the Dow, you know, without this free money. And the only thing that's even keeping the Dow going, it's fallen a little bit, right? But the only thing that's keeping it going is this massive amount of liquidity, money on the sideline. And most of it, is driving a few very large stocks and mergers and acquisitions. That's what's driving the price now, keeping it at, you know, 16,000, 17,000. But when this M&A, merger and acquisition boom, finishes, which it will soon, you're going to see an even deeper contraction of the Dow stock market in the U.S. You know, that's the only thing holding it up right now. Well, they know that. A lot of lobbyists, stock and bond investors and bankers and shadow bankers and so forth, really been lobbying the Federal Reserve strongly before this. Don't raise rates. Don't raise rates. How dare you kill our golden goose? Oh, the housing sector, builders, right, commercial and residential housing builders, they want low rates because they don't want mortgage rates to go up. You know, that'll dampen their already slowing and dampening sector, especially the housing sector. It's gone as high as it's going to go. It can only go down now. And there's still some commercial property possibilities out there. Oh, and multinational corporations, they don't want higher interest rates. And higher interest rates will drive up the value of the dollar, which is already rising. Long-term rates, you know, the Fed doesn't control, it just influences short-term rates. Long-term rates have already been drifting up and cutting into the profits of multinational corporations, you know, like GE and so forth. You know, they don't want interest rates to go up. You know, that would drive the dollar up, and that would make them even more uncompetitive with their other capitalist cousin competitors around the world, you know, in Europe and Asia and so forth. They don't want that, you know, and they're already freaking out because Congress, the right-wingers in particular, it's interesting how they've been opposed to the Export-Import Bank, the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which has been funneling $30, $40 billion a year of subsidies into the likes of companies like General Electric and others, you know, who certainly don't need it with record profits. Yeah, all that is a slush fund exporting. I agree with the teabaggers in Congress on this one. Yeah, it's a waste. You know, this is right-wing populism, you know, sort of peeking out from behind the curtain here in Congress. And, you know, it just causes fits to the big capitalists. You know, now we got maybe the emergence of a little left-wing populism with Bernie Sanders, right? And right-wing populism. And then you have that panderer called Donald Trump who's trying to play into that. But, you know, he's not a populist by any means, even right-wing. You know, they just say what they think people want to hear so they can get a upper leg in this candidate race here. Look, you know, I'm making a prediction. Who's going to be the Republican candidate? Well, it certainly won't be Trump. They'll never allow him. Who will it be? I think it's probably going to be somebody like Kasich from Ohio. Key voting state, Kasich. You know, listen, he's a right-winger, but he's been tacking to the center, that's for sure, trying to sound like, you know, a kind of a Republican populist, whatever that is. That's an oxymoron, but anyway. Yeah, Kasich, I think, is one of the front runners. You know, Bush still has all the money and all the friends, you know, but I don't know that they're going to go with Bush unless he somehow they can give him a shot of adrenaline before he goes on stage. And watch out for this guy Rubio, you know. Rubio from Florida, that's another key swing state. You know, a Kasich Rubio ticket would be formidable, right, for the Republicans. Well, we'll see whether they can do that, pull that one off or not. Anyway, we got a lot of lobbyists who have been pushing for the Fed to keep rates low. And that's what the Fed did. Once again, it indicates they're addicted to free money. They can't get off it anymore. I really think that's a long-term situation. Oh, they wanted to raise it 0.25% as a token. You see, because they know they're creating bubbles, and they know there's another recession coming sooner rather than later. Now, I would say within the next 18 months, global recession. Look, half of the global economy is already in recession. There is an industrial recession, global industrial recession, already underway. If you look at all manufacturing and industrial production around the world, it's negative. Right? There is a global trade recession about, oh, they're right on the cusp of that, you know? I mean, global trade used to grow 10, 12% per year in the previous decade. The first half of this year, no growth, flat. We're on the verge of a global trade recession, global industrial manufacturing recession. Well, what's left? Well, what's left is services. All right, pretty big chunk, services. But that's the only thing keeping things going in the global economy, including the U.S. economy. Look, the U.S. economy growth in recent years, what was it due to? And it's been very low growth, barely 2%, even after they doctored up the GDP numbers here a couple of years ago, still barely 2%. Right? Well, what's behind that 2%? Well, you look at it, it's the shale production, shale oil production, you know, in the shale patch. That's a big part of that. And now that's in retreat. And auto sales. Auto sales have been booming, right? They're giving away autos almost in terms of price. The price hasn't risen much at all, you know, and big discounts. You know, buy it for 7 years, you know, no interest. You know, zero interest, 7 years, finance it 7 years, you know. And, well, why are they able to, the dealers, auto dealers are able to do that, make such nice deals in autos? Well, it's because they securitize the auto loans, just what they did with subprime mortgages. What's securitization? That's when they take the loan, right, and they sell it. They package it with other loans and other types of loans, and they sell it to investors around the world who have all this liquidity and ready to buy anything. And that's what's happening. Securitization of auto loans. Well, will that end up like subprime mortgages? Well, we'll see, right? But that's what's enabled these dealers to give these great deals on new cars, you know, in terms of the discounts and the financing. Now, you may be paying a little bit more for the car, but, you know, they stretch it out for 7 years, six, 7 years, right? Lower the interest rate and so forth. Finance it themselves. The dealers finance it themselves. And they move huge volumes of these cars. Well, autos have helped. Auto sales have helped, right? Shale oil production, boom. You know, that has helped. The dollar has been pretty low until recently. That has helped. But you look beyond that, a little recovery of housing as they've had to build more apartments. It's all housing is all apartment building right now because people got thrown out of their homes and they got to have a place to live, right? So a big boom in apartment and high-end, high-cost single-family homes. You know, that's housing. And it still is only, what, two-thirds recovered from its peak, right? And, you know, you look at that, and that's pretty much where the real growth is. And then, you know, this very slow dribbling up of services of various kinds. Well, most of the hiring has been in services. And services don't pay much, especially when you introduce this new program for years now, several years now, not just in the U.S., but everywhere, of hiring part-time temp works, contingent labor. You know, you pay them one-half to two-thirds of what you pay a full-time person. Actually, you lay off your full-time, and you hire two part-time, and it's cheaper, right? And there's no benefits. So what you've got is, you know, companies are churning full-time out and part-time in. And that means lower wages, and that's why you get job hiring, but you got no wage increase. People are getting low paid, often part-time temp jobs with no benefits. So how can they buy stuff? Oh, on credit, debt. Oh, 7-year auto loans, right? that kind of stuff. That's why the economy can't really get going again. There's not much consumption demand there, unless it's debt financed. You know, people can only take on so much debt, and they're taking on more now, of course. Okay. So the situation is the Federal Reserve keeps interest rates low, and we continue to get financial bubbles as a result. Of course, bubbles can't go on forever. You know, at some point they got to correct, and we're seeing some corrections going on now. As far as emerging markets and other countries, you know, they've been saying, please don't raise rates. Please don't raise rates, because the more U.S. raises rates, the dollar goes up, and all our capital flows out of our countries back to the U.S. for the higher rates. Please don't do that. You know, and the Fed, being the central bank of the world now, has to pay and does pay some attention to emerging market countries that are slipping into deep recessions one after the other across the world here. Brazil, you know, Indonesia. Every country that was involved with oil exports, even Canada, Australia, you know, commodity exporters, they're all in trouble. They're all slipping into recession. Well, if the dollar goes up, you know, money flows out of those countries even more and comes back to the U.S. to go into financial markets. You see, it leaves real markets, real commodity-producing asset manufacturing markets, producing things, hiring people, and it flows into finance here in the U.S. and to some extent Europe and so forth, right? And we even have money capital flowing out of China now, as I said, you know, taking their money and putting it in real estate. And, of course, the Eurozone and Japan are affected by this decision as well. How's that? Well, as long as the U.S. dollar was rising, and if you raised interest rates, it would rise more, that would lower the currencies of Japan, the yen, and Europe, the euro in Europe, the Eurozone. Right? That would make their exports more competitive vis-a-vis the U.S. If we raised rates, right, would raise the value of the dollar, it would hurt U.S. manufacturing multinational corporations, which are beginning to feel the burn. But it would benefit Japanese and benefit Europeans. But now that the U.S. has decided, no, we're going to keep interest rates low again, what that means is that, that's going to have a negative impact on growth in Japan and in Europe. So guess what they're going to do in Japan and Europe? They're going to introduce another QE, no doubt, coming. They already have QEs, trillions of dollars of injection of money and liquidity in their markets, in Japan, in Europe, a lot of which has flowed right out of the markets, right out of the regions, okay, to engage in this global financial speculation. They're going to respond with more QE to drive down their currencies. You see, it's a sort of a whack-a-mole going on, a monetary whack-a-mole globally, as they try to drive down their currencies to get a temporary export advantage to try to grow their real economies by producing exports. But everybody can play that game, you see. The devaluation of your currency game, which is what was played in the 1930s, and that's why global trade and everything slowed so terribly during the 30s, one of the reasons. Right? Everybody can play the devaluation card, and that's what happens. Except now today, you know, they don't play it by officially declaring we're devaluing our currency. They do it by pumping money, the central bank pumping money into the economy, which increases the supply of their currency, right? Which reduces the price of their currency, their exchange rate. So watch for Japan and the Eurozone now to one up once again in terms of currency injections. Or monetary injections, liquidity injections, which lowers the currency exchange rate. So, you know, the global consequences of this Yellen decision here, right? In the U.S., to sum up, it means multinationals will get a break. U.S. multinationals, right? The shale producers will get a break, right? Housing will get a break. Stock and bond speculators will get a break. Well, that's a formidable lobby, isn't it? And the Fed knows that, gosh, they're going to go into this next recession and they're going to have no bullets to shoot. Yeah, interest rates will be near zero, and they've pumped all this liquidity into the economy. Well, what can they do? What can the Fed do monetarily in terms of monetary policy? Should we have another recession in a year? Not much. Not much. Oh, okay, so then we have to have some fiscal spending. Right, but you know, with the U.S. deficit and debt at $18 trillion, right? The ideologues in Congress, especially, say, "Oh, we can't spend any more. We can't have more of a deficit. So how are we going to deal with the next recession? You know, we got all this government debt piled up, and we have all this opposition to any kind of fiscal spending, unless it's tax cuts for companies." That's another beef I have, right? You know, I mean, during Bush, we cut corporate taxes by over $3 trillion. You know? How much have we cut corporate taxes under Obama? Right? Well, twice that amount, if you count, you know, the tax cuts in 2013, $4 trillion additional tax cuts in 2013 to go through 2022. You know, it's been over $6 trillion, $3 trillion under Bush, $6 trillion under, you know, this guy. $10 trillion. Well, what did corporations do with all that extra money from tax cuts? What have they done with the zero interest rates? Reduce my financing costs to zero, right? Give me big tax cuts at the same time. Oh, boy, you've really reduced corporate costs by a huge amount just with those two things. So with interest rates so low, what are corporations doing? They're borrowing the money at near zero rates, and they're giving that borrowed money to the shareholders. At the same time, they've generated super profits. Not from selling stuff, more stuff, not from raising the prices of what they've sold, because economies are too weak to raise the prices. They just cut costs. In other words, they take it out of workers' hides. They cut costs. They cut wages. They cut benefits, so forth. It's called profit margins, you see, operating margins. Reduce your operating margin and profit that way. See, there's three ways to make more profits. You know, you can raise your price, you can sell more of something, you can cut costs. That's it. So how have they generated these super profits? You know, over profits have doubled here since the recovery for corporations. Well, they've done that primarily by reducing costs, you see. Not by selling more so much and not by raising prices that they can't. Prices, you know, of goods and services have been drifting down. They're barely growing 1% in the U.S. and elsewhere. They are zero or less. We got deflation in goods, you know, over in Europe. In Japan, and we're down to 1%. So it's not prices are being raised on all this stuff. And they're certainly not selling more, you know, appreciably, because people just don't have the consumption income to real disposable income to purchase, you know, significant consumption gains. They're doing it all out of debt, unless you're rich, top 10%. You know, then you got all this stock market profits. So they've been cutting costs. Right, since 2009, generated super profits that way, zero interest rates, no cost there, big $1 trillion tax cuts, reduced cost there, and guess what? The result is they're sitting on cash piles of trillions and trillions of dollars. I just wrote an article, I'll post it here probably when it appears in Telesur, on global corporate cash piles exceed $15 trillion. Yeah, corporations are piling up the cash. Corporations today have at least $7 to $8 trillion just looking at Europe, the U.S., and Japan. Cash on hand, corporate cash on hand, officially, of $7.3 trillion. Right. Now, that $7.3 trillion is only half of the iceberg, because at the same time, that $7.3 trillion is what is left over after corporations have given more than $8 trillion back to their shareholders and stockholders in stock buybacks and dividends and other cash-out schemes. $8 trillion since 2010 have been distributed to their shareholders, investors. Big investors mostly hold most of the shares. $8 trillion. And they still have $7.3 trillion left on their balance sheets. That's over $15 trillion in cash, distributed and undistributed, generated in the last 5 years. I mean, that boggles the mind, right? $15 trillion plus. And that's just, you know, the advanced economies. And the advanced economies, Japan, the U.S., and Europe. Well, where's it come from, right? Well, I'll tell you where it comes from, right? Cash pile. Let's just talk about the cash pile that's left, right? Bank of Japan has indicated this past June that corporate cash, Japanese companies' corporate cash, now totals $2.4 trillion. That's very interesting, you know, that Japanese corporations could generate so much cash when they've had four recessions in Japan since 2008. Yeah, four times Japanese economy has fallen into recession. Well, you would think in recession they wouldn't have that much profits, right? No, there's no correlation anymore between profits and recession. $2.4 trillion they've generated. How about Europe? How about Europe? Europe, $1.1 trillion in cash. Despite a double-dip recession of 18 months in 2011-13 and a growth in the eurozone of barely 0.2% per quarter ever since. Yeah. So, add another $1.1 trillion. By the way, that's a 40% increase in corporate cash since 2008. 40% increase. Okay, so that's what, 6 years? You know, that's like 7% per year or whatever of cash. All right, despite having a double-dip recession and stagnation for most of the time. Yeah, so $3.5 trillion sitting over there in Japanese and European corporations. Oh, and they're supposed to be doing so poorly. And they're pumping more QE into their economies. And they're all talking about how they can take more money back from workers and the wages. You know, they've already been leading the way with this contingent labor thing in the last 5 years in both of those countries. You know, all the hires have been part-time temp in Japan and in Europe. But, you know, it's the average percent of contingent workers hired in Europe in the last 5 years has been 50 to 70%. In Italy, 70% of all hires have been part-time temp, contingent. In Germany, over half. Spain, 65%, right? That's all they're hiring now, part-timers. And believe it or not, we're doing the same thing. Cooking the numbers, so we tend to underestimate that. You know, look, even the U6 unemployment rate, which officially acknowledges part-time temp, is over 10% in this country. 10% of 157 million worker labor force, that's still over 15 million people unemployed in the U.S. And those who got jobs, you know, they got low-paying jobs. Well, no wonder there's no real wage recovery and consumption going on. Okay, so let's go back. Europe, $1.1 trillion. Japan, $2.4 trillion. So $3.5 trillion in corporate cash piles on hand, on balance sheets. How about the U.S.? Well, Moody's Analytics Research estimates non-financial corporations in the U.S. have $1.73 trillion in cash. But you got to add another $1 trillion for financial corporations in their excess reserves. Okay, so that's 2.7. Oh, but wait a minute. Then there's at least another $1.1 trillion that U.S. multinational corporations have stuffed in their offshore subsidiaries and won't be back, bring back to pay on taxes. Okay, so, you know, that's probably another amount. So we're already up to over $3.5 trillion. That's $3.8 trillion cash pile for U.S. corporations. Right. But that doesn't even count other money, other cash equivalent here in the U.S. for U.S. corporations that they're not counting as cash, right? Like all the money that corporations stuff into depreciation funds or other hidden funds that they don't count as cash on their balance sheet, but it's there. It's there as cash. And then they don't invest it. They just park it in those funds. Right? Or cash they've stuffed in offshore tax havens and don't report, or purposely underestimate as a result of widespread tax fraud by U.S. corporations in the U.S. You know? So, you know, it's really, when we say $3.8 trillion of cash, you know, I don't know what those other numbers are. No one knows. But it's probably significant. We're probably talking about trillions additional, right? And then the $7.3 trillion in cash on balance sheets, you know, we're just talking about U.S., Europe, and Japan. You know, what about the Middle East, the Saudis, and their regional emirate friends, you know? You think they're stuffing money in Swiss, Luxembourg, and Singapore banks? You betcha, right? So if we included all of these probabilities, you know, we're probably talking about over $10 trillion in corporate cash just in, you know, those Saudi Emirate petro economy corporations in Europe, U.S., and Japan. $10 trillion. Now, that $10 trillion, as I said, is after massive stock buybacks. How much just in the U.S. has the U.S. corporations bought back, spent buying back their stock? You know, when you buy back your stock, you're going to give cash to your shareholders, right? In exchange for the stock. $4.5 trillion in the U.S. alone has been distributed in stock buybacks and dividend payouts for just the largest 500 Standard & Poor's U.S. corporations. That's a Standard & Poor number. $4.5 trillion since 2010 in additional stock buybacks, higher than the level that existed in 2008. $4.5 trillion in stock and dividend buybacks for just the 500 largest corporations. You got to add another $500 billion in dividend distributions, according to the Commerce Department, to all businesses. So we're talking about $5 trillion just in the U.S. in stock buybacks. And they're still sitting on $3.8 trillion in cash, right, after these buybacks. By the way, that doesn't count $1.3 trillion distributed in just the last 3 years by private equity firms, and probably more by global hedge funds and other shadow banks to their partners. They don't even call that cash. They call that, it's not called stock buybacks or dividend payouts. It's called interest sharing, interest distribution. To call those, that cash, interest, you see. And in Europe and Japan, you know, what about the stock buybacks there? Well, the stock buybacks are not as great in Japan and Europe as they are in the U.S. The U.S. loves that way of redistributing wealth and profits and income to its shareholders. They don't do that as much in Japan and Europe. But the numbers are rising there in stock buybacks as well. You know, in Europe over the past year, the amount of stock buybacks increased 15% in Japan. In the past year, 16.8%. So we're probably over $1 trillion there as well. They do pay out more, though, in dividends, particularly in Europe. So, you know, if we added the stock buybacks and the dividends, I don't have exact numbers, but talk about another $1 to $2 trillion, right? So you add that to the $6.3 trillion in the U.S., just in the form of stock buybacks, dividends, and private equity payouts to partners, you know, that's $6.3 trillion. You add, you know, at least another $1 to $2 trillion in Europe and Japan in buybacks and and certainly dividends. You got over $8 trillion in cash distributed to shareholders and investors since 2009, after leaving us still with the $7.3 trillion in still undistributed cash piles on corporate balance sheets. And then if we add Saudi Arabia, you know, so forth, it's probably more. Yeah? I don't have numbers there. So we'll just, we won't even count that. We won't even count the Saudis and their friends, right? Certainly trillions, but we won't even count that. We're just, you know, just looking at the U.S., Europe, and Japan. You know, they're sitting on $7.3 trillion in still undistributed cash after they paid out more than $8 trillion. Well, that easily, minimum, adds up to over $15 trillion in corporate cash generated, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, where did they get all this cash? Well, it was tax cuts. They get to keep some of it, right? Low interest rates. They don't have to pay. And mostly it's taking it back from workers. You know, it's profit margin, profits. And now globally, you know, after relying on this converting most of the workers or a huge number of workers to part-time temp contingent jobs, low-paid, so forth, right? After that, after destroying the union, so collective bargaining, you can't get any wage gains in any kind of recovery. Unions are just a shell of what they were. They can't get much in the way of recovery of wages for their members anymore, you know. They're lucky if they can hold on to their fringe benefits, which they can't. They're taking that away, too. Fringe benefits are being taken away. Right. Now they're all turning to, guess what? Labor market restructuring in Europe and everywhere. You know, right now in Finland, big strikes. Tens of thousands of workers against the 5% labor restructuring wage cut, you know. France has proposed this. Yeah, socialist government, yeah. Spain has already implemented. Italy's about to implement it to put more restrictions on strikes in Germany and in the UK. Right, Japan has a new program, the labor market restructuring. Watch out, is coming here. Yeah, coming here as well. I'll, you know, keep this thing going. Take more back. Squeeze the labor force. That's how you make your profits from producing things. The way you really make profits is to get free money from the Federal Reserve to go speculate in financial markets, stocks and bonds and foreign exchange and derivatives and all this kind of stuff. You know, that's where the big money is made. And they're still making money by squeezing the rest of us. So, corporate cash piles, over $15 trillion minimum, while the rest of us are wondering, how the heck are we even going to pay our rent? That's the 21st century global capitalism. That's where it's going. And it's not over yet. No? Okay. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. On that happy note, we'll talk to you all next week. Walk the streets of screaming now.